Thank you very much, Pedro. So thanks a lot for the invitation. And it's really great to have a chance to discuss this work with you guys. And so this is work that was done together with these really great collaborators, Colia, Julius, and Michelangelo. And I should say we're also supported by the ERC, Colia's grant. And so we are all people who come from trying to study n equals 4 superior Mills and other theories using integrability. But here, indeed, we try to combine this with this other very powerful method to study conformance field theories in higher dimensions, which is the conformal bootstrap, which uses completely different principles. And in particular, what we want to explore is if we can use the considerable information we have on the theory from integrability. In particular, here I will mean spectral data for the spectrum of single trace operators at finite coupling. And if we can use these as an input for the conformal bootstrap and try to solve the theory in this way. I should also say that essentially some similar things were done in the context of some 2D critical models of statistical mechanics, even though the methods that they used are very different. And I will explain why. So and the motivations is, of course, that this combined approach is likely to be more powerful than these two approaches alone. I will say in a moment what are the current limitations of integrability in terms of the bootstrap. So this we've seen, for example, in the case of the 3D easing model, that the conformal bootstrap is extremely powerful. In some cases, really allows you to zoom on a theory and solve it numerically. But typically, it gives bounds. And when we can use it to solve a theory, usually it's because this theory lies at the boundary of these bounds of allowed conformal data. But what happens when the theory is inside the bounds, which is what seems to be the case for conformal gauge theories at finite coupling, such as n equals 4. And here the hope is that by injecting more input from integrability, we can move the theory closer to the bounds, or rather move the boundary closer to the theory. Then we can also see this one motivation is that we want to generate predictions for future integrability methods, where we will certainly need to make many conjectures. It would be nice to have data to test them against. And then another motivation is that this will allow us to explore more the non-planar regime and maybe even get more insights on what methods we should use to solve the theory in the end. Okay, so I will just give a brief introduction and then explain what is the setup that we study, why we choose this particular setup, which would be a 1D CFT, which is embedded in n equals 4 superior Mills. It's the CFT that lives on a supersymmetric Wilson line in n equals 4. I will explain how integrability allows us to compute the spectrum of this 1D CFT, and then combining it with the bootstrap study OPE coefficients. And then I will discuss some outlook and future directions we want to explore. So when we discuss integrability, today I will be talking about n equals 4 superior Mills at large n, where n is the rank of the gauge group. And the goal would be to study it at finite Toft coupling. So the story of integrability starts with the observation that single trace operators or equivalently closed strings can be seen as states on an integrable spin chain, very famously. And using this observation, first perturbatively, it was possible to deduce the values for the conformal dimensions as eigenvalues at one loop of an integrable Hamiltonian on the spin chain. And then after a lot of work and many contributions, there was this beautiful non-perturbative method, which is called the quantum spectral curve, that was developed. And this essentially allows us to more or less get any information we want about the spectrum of single trace operators at large n. So with this method, it's possible to compute the spectrum numerically at finite lambda. It's possible to do quite sophisticated things like analytic continuation in the spin, follow Regge trajectories, study the Pomeron and BFKL physics, study very high order of perturbation theory analytically, and also with an adaptation of this method, one can study non-local operators, such as the ones that I will mention in a little bit. So apart from the spectrum, I just want to mention that there is a lot more integrability in the theory. In particular, essentially all worksheets should be integrable in ADS5 cross S5. In particular, when we don't want to worry about boundary conditions, all closed strings worksheets are integrables, which means that all the correlation functions of single trace operators should be solvable in principle, even at all orders in 1 over n. And many more observables should be solvable at finite coupling. So here, I apologize, I didn't put any references because I won't talk about this type of integrability more, but there's a lot of progress, a lot of methods such as the hexagonalization, the separation of variables, the study of fishnet theory. But what I want to stress is that we are not quite there yet. And in particular, it's still, we don't have the same understanding of these observables as the one we have for the spectrum. And the OPE coefficients of generic single trace operators are still essentially impossible to compute at finite coupling lambda. So the very naive idea, I will say in a second why it's wrong, but the naive idea is that if we look at the crossing equation for a four-point function, so here it's the crossing equation that comes from decomposing the OPE in the channel 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 1, 4, 2, 3. This equation involves essentially linearly the product of OPE coefficients. We know the spectrum, so we know where the sum runs, and we can just naively try to solve this equation, this linear equation, and compute the OPE coefficients. And of course, there are many subtleties, but an important one is that for there is also at planar level, there's not only a contribution from single trace operators, but also from double trace operators. So if we study a four-point function of local operators in a large N-gauge theory, because of large N factorization, the first contribution is essentially trivial. And here in the OPE appear only double trace operators, which have a trivial classical scaling dimension, and also OPE coefficient given by the generalized free theory. And then the order we're interested in is the connected one, the next one. And this receives contributions both from single trace operators and also from subleading conformal data of the double trace operators, which is something we don't know from integrability. So we would need to.
So this problem you mentioned is only there for like a subset zero of all correlators, right? Because most of the two-point functions are zero.
What do you mean?
Most of the if you have generic four-point function, then it would never be true that there is this first.
But this part is not a problem. Like in any case, it's known. But what is in principle a subtlety is that we don't know this part, which appears in the other interesting term. And so in principle, we would need to bootstrap also this data essentially. And to avoid this complication for the moment, we study a setup where there isn't this complication. So the setup is essentially an observables, which are operators inserted inside a Wilson line. And here, essentially, there is no distinction between single trace or double trace operators because they're all inside just one trace, which defines the Wilson line. And so this is the defect CFT. So more explicitly, I consider the supersymmetric Wilson line in n equals 4 super EMLs, which is constructed with this form of the gauge connection that contains the gluon and also one of the scalar fields of the theory. So remember that n equals 4 has six scalar fields, and here we choose one with one polarization that will be denoted as phi parallel. And this Wilson line is supersymmetric, so it will have expectation value 1. But we can insert operators built as some products of the elementary fields with no trace. So they're all inside just one trace over SUN. And this defines a set of correlation functions that actually should have a 1D conformal invariance on the line. And they are also interesting because these operator insertions can be seen as generating small bumps in the shape of the Wilson line. So in principle, these correlation functions contain information about deforming the shape of the line. And also, I just mentioned that there is a dual perturbative 2D QFT description at strong coupling. So in a way, this theory will behave in a simple way at large values of lambda. And because this is a line embedded in 4D, in principle, one can study various types of bootstrap approaches. So one approach would involve both the bulk data of n equals 4 and the data on the line. But instead here, we will just use the conformal bootstrap restricted to the line. Okay, so this theory, as I said, as a one, the theory defining these correlation functions has a 1D conformal symmetry, which is just built by these three generators, dilatation translations and spatial conformal translations on the line. And then it has some global symmetries. So one is just comes from the rotations that leave this line in 4D invariant, SO3. And then there is an SO5 worth of rotations of the scalars of n equals 4. So these are the scalars that are orthogonal to the one coupled to the line. And altogether, these symmetries are combined into a superconformal group of this 1D CFT, which is this OSP 2.2/4. What will be important for this talk is just to list two of the superconformal multiplets. So the simplest one has a dimension that's protected by supersymmetry. The scaling dimension is 1 for the primary. And this primary is any of these orthogonal scalars. Then there is another multiplet with protected dimension 2, and it's built out of this symmetrized combination of two orthogonal scalars. And then the theory has a lot of non-protected operators. The simplest one perturbatively is just built by inserting one operator that now is the one parallel to the line. And then these other two will also appear. So these are just the operators with classical dimension 2. They're built out of this parallel scalar, some neutral combination of two fields, essentially, involving this parallel scalar and a neutral combination of the other ones. And so we will study a particular four-point function for our bootstrap setup, which is a four-point function of four of these operators protected by supersymmetries in this multiplet B1. And because of conformal invariance, it takes this form depending just on a single cross ratio on the line. And then there is a crossing equation that comes from the fact that the line can be mapped to a circle. So I have a cyclic symmetry where I can send 1, 2, 3, 4 to 4, 1, 2, 3. And this redefines this cross ratio in this way. So to set up the bootstrap, now we need to discuss the OPE decomposition. And of course, it's useful to take into account of supersymmetry. And to do that, we don't use just the standard conformal blocks, but we use the superconformal blocks that luckily all of this was worked out in this beautiful paper. And so using supersymmetry, it's convenient to repackage the four-point function in terms of this other function f. This is related in an explicit way to the other amplitude I defined earlier, and the small f satisfies a crossing in this form. And this is the explicit form of the OPE decomposition, where this is the channel where I'm fusing 1, 2, and 3, 4 together. As proved in this paper, the operators that flow in the OPE are the identity operator. Then there is the next supersymmetric operator in this multiplet B2, which I discussed earlier. And then there is an infinite tower of non-protected operators, which all have a characteristic that they are singlets under the global symmetry of the 1D CFT. So SO5 times SO3. And of course, these have non-trivial scaling dimension and OPE coefficients that depend on the Toft coupling constant. And so these functions here are the superconformal blocks, which are given explicitly here. And for this part, they depend explicitly on the cross ratio and also on the unknown dimensions of the exchanged operators. So the supersymmetric operators exchanged here have an OPE coefficient that in principle depends on the coupling constant of the theory, but this is also something that can be fixed uniquely. So this was fixed essentially by studying another observable, which is a topological correlator that can be computed by comparison with localization and has an OPE coefficient that it's identical, but without the exchange of the non-protected operators. And out of the computation of this observable, one can fix this quantity. So from now on, this would be some known datum of the theory.
Andre, on your previous slide, I think you have the same thing denoted in two ways, right? This f equals c112 and cbps, right?
Yes, this c112 is cbps. Sorry, thank you. Indeed. So putting everything together, this OPE decomposition together with this crossing symmetry of f can be written into this equation that would be the conformal bootstrap constraint. So here I just am grouping together the conformal blocks with the crossed block where the cross ratio goes into one minus chi. And this is the equation. So because I know everything about the contribution of the identity and this supersymmetric multiplet B2, I will always treat them together and redefine this block G1 plus B2, which is an explicit function of lambda and the cross ratio. And the unknowns for the conformal bootstrap are the spectrum and OPE coefficient. And so before moving to what we can compute with integrability, I just want to mention that there are existing results just using the bootstrap or the bootstrap plus other insights from direct computations. And in particular, there are some numerical bootstrap studies which show this fact that I mentioned earlier, that at finite coupling, the theory seems to live inside the bounds and it goes to the boundary at strong coupling. And there are also nice results using a functional bootstrap approach, where essentially Meneghel and Ferrero, they studied how to solve the theory iteratively in at strong coupling, using the fact that the spectrum at strong coupling is simple. The theory becomes essentially free at strong coupling. And then using assumptions on the form of functions and the composition in harmonic polylogarithms of the four-point function, order by order. There is an ansatz that comes from considerations about amplitudes in ADS2. And using this information, they set up these analytic methods and they got this perturbative exact analytical data. For in particular, this is the scaling dimension of this first non-protected operator, and this is its OPE coefficient at strong coupling. So now I'll discuss how integrability helps to compute the spectrum. And for this, one needs to consider actually a slightly generalized setup that was studied a lot in the past 10 years, which is essentially where we consider operators inserted at a cusp between two supersymmetric Wilson line. So there are these two extra parameters that are a geometric angle of the line, and there is also a jump in the polarization of the scalar coupled to the two lines. And here, the idea is that the perturbative picture of integrability is similar to the one in the spectrum. So this operator is made of different fields, and they, at weak coupling, they interact with the same type of spin chain interactions as in the spin chain that describes local operators. But now this spin chain is open and has some boundary interactions which describe the Wilson lines. And so this original setup actually was initially developed for insertions that are of operators that are charged and are orthogonal to the two lines. So this doesn't seem immediately relevant for us. And it looked a bit more difficult to describe the operators that are built with scalars that have the same quantum numbers as the lines. So, although there are signs, and especially it was worked out in one sector and one loop, that these are also integrable, essentially. And however, out of these studies, there is a non-perturbative method was developed to describe these cusp observables. And in particular, it can be used to describe the cusp with no insertions, which is an interesting observable in its own. And it's given by a version of the boundary thermodynamic Bethe ansatz, or alternatively, it was then turned into a version of the quantum spectral curve. And it was realized recently that the operators we want to study essentially should be seen as some excited states of the same quantum spectral curve equations that describe the cusp with no insertions. So we should start from the equations that describe this setup, then take this angle to zero, and also consider the case with no insertions. This observable becomes trivial, and the quantum spectral curve equations has a ground state that just has no scaling dimension, just value zero, but then it has infinitely many excited states also that describe the states, the neutral states of this one DCFT. And this was realized considering different limits. And in particular, it was already tested for the third state in some works by two of my collaborators with David Grabner, which was very useful as a prerequisite for this work. So, and before discussing how we solve this equation, I just want to tell you a little bit about how this quantum spectral.
Sorry, can I ask something, Andrea, just to make sure I understand? So, you want to study the straight infinite line without any angle, right? But with an insertion. But what you do is you start with an angle, you solve it, and then you remove the angle.
Yeah. So, well, you can start from the equation with the angle and just take a limit at the level of the equations, and you can get some equations without the angle already, and then we solve them.
Okay. But the analysis directly on the infinite line with a bunch of insertions, is it easier to derive that rather than starting with a cusp, or it's better to start with a cusp?
So,
What is the advantage of starting with a cusp? You were not discussing cusps until now, and then you put a cusp, but you remove it right away. So why are we putting
I can try. So if you just consider a straight line, anomalous dimension is zero, and all Qs and Ps are equal to zero. right? But if you start from excited state, if you introduce cusps, then all states at the same footing, none of them is protected. And equations mm-hmm. Do not yeah. trivialize. So just the matter of keeping it non-trivial, you know.
But it's to follow the states more easily, to lift the degeneracy.
Yeah, but at the end, the equations we solve are for zero ended, so you can start.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Right. So, I want to tell you a little bit about what are these quantum structural curve equations, and so they're a universal type of equations that exist in integrable systems, but here they have some peculiarities and how they appear in n equals 4. But so the idea is they are equations that describe these fundamental objects of integrable systems called the Q functions that are some complex functions of an auxiliary parameter called the spectral parameter U. And these constraints are made of some algebraic part and some analytic part. So the algebraic part is some functional relations that relate different Q functions. So these Q functions form a kind of multiplet, and these functional relations reflect the underlying symmetry of the model. And then to specify the model, one has also to describe the analytic properties of the Q functions. For example, in the Heisenberg spin chain, one has that these are the functional relations related to SU2, and the Q functions are polynomials. So these polynomials are actually the roots, are the famous beta roots. And one also specifies the explicit form of this function Q12 obtained by fusion. And then one can see that out of this relation, one can derive the standard and form of the beta equations. So if you start from this equation and then shift it and then evaluate it at the roots of one of the Q functions, essentially this will kill one term of the determinant. And then if you can shift the equation in the other way and take a ratio and get these equations. So this equation on its own can be used to essentially solve for all states of the system by just finding all solutions of these equations for two polynomials Q1 and Q2. And then the integrals of motion of the system are encoded into these polynomials, into the roots in this case. And so there is a generalization for the observables in n equals 4, even where the Q functions are not polynomials. And in fact, there is no underlying system of beta equations that is valid at finite coupling. But again, these equations have the same ingredients. So there is an algebraic part that in our case, these are functional equations that encode the original system, the original symmetry of n equals 4 PSU 2,2/4. And then they have some special identifications in the case of the cusp. And then these functions have some analytic properties that here are a bit more complicated. So these are functions with cuts. And interestingly, the position of the cuts is the only place where the Toft coupling enters the construction. So, and to be really a bit more explicit, this quantum spectral curve equation for the straight line for the states of this one DCFT, explicitly we need to specify these conditions. So there are some Q functions which are called P, which are functions with only one cut on the main Riemann sheet. And this means that they can be represented as some Taylor series in this particular variable, which essentially this is a series that converges on the whole first sheet with a single cut between minus 2g and 2g. So in the previous slide, these are these functions. And in this way, they are parameterized out of these constants on this first Riemann sheet and a bit beyond. So these C's are seen as parameters, and also the scaling dimension of the operators is a parameter of the construction, which actually appears already in the C's. And then the idea is that using these parameters and using this functional relation, there is a way to construct all other Q functions in this multiplet. And then one needs to impose some quantization condition, which is essentially is a condition for how two Q functions should glue together on two sides of one particular cut. So concretely, one constructs these functions called the bold Q, and then one needs to impose this particular equation where this Q tilde means the function below the cut. And the way to solve numerically for the spectrum is to essentially use Newton's method, then tune these parameters until these equations are satisfied.
What's and the physical meaning of these gluing equations?
Yeah, so, well, so there, in some way, they encode the boundary reflection factor. And so it's not completely understood how to derive them in general. They satisfy a lot of constraints. But if you look at the large L limit, it appears that they're kind of related to crossing, essentially.
But crossing on the worksheet.
Yeah, of the asymptotic beta ansatz description.
Okay, so this is not really, so u and minus u, it's 2 points, it's not the same point, right? One is like 3, one is minus 3, right?
It's, yeah.
Pedro, to help you a bit, remember on the classical limit, you have this p of 1 over x equal to p of x?
Yeah.
So that's essentially this, and then u to minus u is just because the bound, there is a reflection from the boundary.
Mm. I see. So in the closed spectrum, there would be no minus u.
Yeah. Well, there is actually.
Okay.
Right, Collier.
Okay,
minus u is still there.
No, minus u is there only for symmetric case. Otherwise, you could do
bar.
Upper or lower.
Yeah.
Well, generally, can do complex conjugation.
Yeah, so the difference in the local case, there wouldn't be this cinch part, and the matrix would be a bit different. And one can trace these factors to the particular form of the reflection factor. If you look at the large L form of the Q function, essentially what imposes this equation is the crossing equation for the building blocks of the dressing phases. Okay, so we're interested to try to find all solutions of these equations. As I said, we use a Newton method with many parameters. And for that, in practice, it's very useful to have good starting points. And for us, it was really necessary to build a good algorithm to first solve the equations at weak coupling. And then with that, we have a kind of classifications of the solutions. And then we start from weak coupling and we can track them in a finite coupling region. And for that was also very useful, some results that Julius worked out on his own. Okay, and so using this method, now we can study in principle as many states as we want. And this is a sample where we computed 35 states that flow in this OPE. So as you can see here, so this spectrum is it's very regular at weak and strong coupling. At strong coupling, they just go to integer. They cluster in groups and go to integers. And but in the middle region, it's a bit more chaotic. So there are many level crossings. And also the density of the spectrum increases quite fast. So these level crossings, by the way, are also expected in n equals 4, where they're a property expected in integrable systems in general, and in n equals 4, they're expected at large n, and then it's expected that they will be lifted at finite n. And you can also see here that the plot is less dense, so we didn't compute the dimensions of all states starting from these classical dimensions. But actually in the method that I will describe in a moment to bootstrap the value of an OPE coefficient, in the end, we will use only the value of a couple of states.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes, please.
You said that in the middle region, in this plot, these are some chaotic and there is some level crossing, and yes, I can see that. But there are some clustering of these yellow lines and the green lines towards the high coupling, right?
Yes.
I can see that. Correct. So do they have any special significance, or is it just like going to some, like they're converging at certain point, or?
Yes.
So what is it?
At strong coupling, this is again, this is described by a free theory,
uh-huh.
And then this dual weakly coupled 2D QFT. So at strong coupling, they go to integer values that describe the classical values of these dual fields, and so they essentially converge. They're converging to these values,
but only like some of them, right? Not everything converges at strong coupling. I mean, I can see some cluster of green lines, and then there's some cluster of, so there is a particular class of operators that converges to the to like a free value of a perturbative theory, to a dual perturbative theory at strong coupling, is it?
Yeah, it's all of them. I think actually we have data up to 4, and you see a bit.
Yeah. Well, just higher states, they take longer to converge, basically.
I see. Okay.
But they all end up integers, and the yellow line is end up at 7, actually. So you see, go all the way to 7. But otherwise, it's integer. Yeah. If you extrapolate it.
I see. Okay. Fine. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so now, in principle, we want to understand how to use this equation that we have the spectrum. And of course, there are like two problems to solve. One is that we can only ever solve for a finite number of levels. So how do we truncate this sum exactly? And then, of course, this equation is for functions of the cross ratio. And just let me remind you for a moment of the structure of the equation. So there will be this conformal block, which is a well-known fixed explicit function, which is this identity plus B2 contribution. And then this unknown function where now we know the spectrum, which parameterizes the form of these conformal blocks. So the first naive method that we attempted is is actually the one that was used in these papers about 2D critical models. And this method is very simple. It's just you truncate the equation. You try to sample this equation at some random values for the cross ratio. And then if you get, if you use the same number of points as equations, you get a square linear system and you solve it for the OP coefficients. But of course, if you choose different sampling points, you get a different result. And what was done in this paper was just to do statistics over these different choices. And in their cases, it converged if you increase the truncation. But for us, this actually, it gives a very poor result, like 100% error estimated on the OP coefficients at finite coupling. And this was already realized in this paper, but they were able to use some special features of 2D CFTs, like presence of degenerate fields, to group together the levels in some special way, and then it worked for them. But we cannot use this method. So which is the more systematic approach?
I have another question, sorry. So in the previous slide, you said that this gives a poor result for a dense spectrum. So it is related to this, the way in which the truncation is done, or is it related to the truncation method that you're keeping some operators and, or is it because of the level crossing? I think it's because of the level crossing a little bit.
Yeah, these levels are very close.
Yeah, because in the middle of your previous graph, you had this the chaotic part, and then that's the region you're interested in while you're trying to solve for this equation.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, but whenever two levels come close to each other, becomes badly.
Yes. Different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So in a more advanced, so the way to think about these equations, which is used in a conformal bootstrap, is instead to transform these functional equations into scalar equations using some linear functionals that act on the space of functions of the cross ratio. So these linear functions, for example, can be represented as some combination of derivatives acting on the cross ratio at some point like half, where the OPE converges the fastest in both channels. And then the logic of the game is to try to find some functionals with good properties that allow you to extract maximal information from the equations. And just to give an example, now we know the spectrum. So suppose we could find some functionals or a family of functionals with the property that when they act on a conformal block for one state of the spectrum, they give you one and they annihilate the ones corresponding to all the other states in the spectrum. Then if we had these functionals, we would have essentially an analytic solution of for the OP coefficients, because this equation will just project into two terms and then you can solve it. And of course, we don't know, this would be asking too much. Although these functions with these properties are known for essentially a spectrum of the free theory, it's not, we didn't try to use them in our setup. Maybe they can be useful, but more pragmatically, you can try to find numerically some functionals that are very small after a certain threshold. And this gives you a better way to truncate the equation and already gives us good results. But on top of that, what we wanted to use is to use the fact that the 1D CFT is unitary. So the square of the OP coefficients is positive. And then what is done in the conformal bootstrap is to use some functionals with some positivity properties to derive some inequalities and use this to find allowed regions for the conformal data. So for this, the framework that we'll use is that we will look for functionals that are not necessarily small, but they are required to be non-negative above a certain value of the scaling dimension. And to impose this kind of condition, one can use some techniques that are called semi-definite programming that allow you to navigate into this space of functionals. And they were introduced in the conformal bootstrap by Simon Staffin, who also created this really powerful package STPB to find these functionals numerically. And this is what we used in this work. And the very nice thing about this method is it's essentially the only source of approximation would be the fact that we represent this functional as a finite combination of derivatives, but it can be proved that the bounds that we will get on the conformal data can only get better if we increase the number of derivatives. So there will be rigorous bounds. So, and uses this technique, this is the first experiment that we tried to do. And this is an adaptation of a known algorithm in the conformal bootstrap, where now we will use the fact that we know something about the spectrum. And so the algorithm is the will work in this way. So we'll look for a functional that should take the value 1 on the block for the first non-trivial state in the spectrum. Then we impose that from the next state, delta 2 should be positive. So here it's where we give information about the position of delta 1 and delta 2. And among all these functions with these two properties, we look for the one that maximizes its value on this identity block. And if you find such functional, you see that this equation becomes an inequality because all this contribution from this tail is just a positive number. And out of this, you get an upper bound for the OP coefficient of the first state. And you can also modify slightly the algorithm so that it gives you a lower bound. So here you just look for another functional that now takes the value -1 on this block for the first state. And then it's easy to see that this will be another functional, will give you another value and now a lower bound. And before showing the results, let me just plot an example of the value of these functionals on the conformal blocks for the different values of delta in the spectrum. So this is, for example, the one for the upper bound. You can see it has the value 1 on the first state. And then notice that although we just imposed that it should be positive after this threshold, it's actually very small. And the same is true for the other functional. So this is it's a very good sign because it tells us that even though we didn't give it any information on the position of these states in the spectrum, it won't matter much. And we can hope to find actually a precise result for the OP coefficient. And in fact, what we find with this method is this plot. So this is obtained for different values of the coupling constant just by running the previous algorithm for any lambda. And we obtain a lower and upper bound. And in this plot is represented the field region between these two bounds. So you can see that essentially it looks like a line already. And of course, these bounds get better and better if we increase the number of derivatives. We can try to do an extrapolation and we see that there is an ultimate width of the bound. So it doesn't go to 0. And this is an estimate of the error. And roughly we get like in the worst region is like a 1% error on the result. And so this was our main result in this work because it's essentially something that presently it's beyond the reach of integrability methods. But of course, there are many, many questions. And one is we would like also to try to find information on the other OP coefficients. And to do this, the experiment that we try to play is now we want to introduce in the game also the OP coefficients for the next two states, delta 2 and delta 3. We can do this by treating them as parameters, and we group them together with the identity block. And then you run exactly the same algorithm. So again, you look for a functional that has the same properties, that it takes the value 1 or minus 1 here, then it should be positive over the next state that now is the state of delta 4. And now it should maximize its value on this new redefined identity block. So in this way, you get some new bounds for C1, which depends parametrically on these other two unknown OP coefficients. And you can see where these bounds become inconsistent with the previous one, or maybe they become just nonsense. Like you could find that the lower bound is higher than the upper bound. And in this way, you can trace some allowed island for this C2 and C3 that in this case has this form. So we find an island that is very narrow in one direction, but still has some width in the other direction. So presently the method is not able to resolve completely between these two, between these two states essentially, which are quite close in the plot for the spectrum. So to summarize and list some questions and ideas for future work. So we found this surprisingly good result for an OPE coefficient. And what was striking for us is that the input we needed to use from integrability was essentially just on the position of the first two states. And we found this result, which was quite good, but the resolution is finite. So one important conceptual question is, how do we shrink these bounds to zero? Is it possible? And also, we would like to find the equally good results for the OP coefficient for the excited states. And maybe underline all this, the conceptual question is it possible that from just the spectrum, one can solve mathematically for a CFT? And then of course, in terms of studying n equals four, maybe the most important question is if we can apply some techniques similar to this to study the case of local operators working around this problem of the double traces. And let me just list some ideas and things that we've been exploring a little bit. So one about the problem of trying to shrink the bounds. So there are ways to get better results. So we found some way to essentially insert new data from integrability that already allows us to reduce this error by a factor of 50 so far. And then of course one can use a lot of other ideas. So one idea is to use the more equations coming from the study of more correlators. This is typically in the bootstrap what really allows you to reduce these islands to points. For example, for the 3D easing, is the combination of two correlators that really brings you to the island. And then we can try to develop new types of algorithms. Because we know the spectrum, we can relax this positivity of the functionals after a certain threshold. We can allow a functional to be negative, for example, in some gap where there are no states. And with this, we have also some preliminary results that show that one can gain some more precision. But of course, we haven't explored this yet, actually, but with this new precision, there is the hope that we can resolve this C2 and C3, maybe get better data for higher excited states. I hope so, we haven't tried yet. And another thing to try would be to try to use other approaches like the Polyakov bootstrap or these analytic functionals that exist in 1D. This would be like a completely different set of bootstrap equations that could give more constraints. And then I think another interesting direction would be to try to play a similar game, but with a very different setup. That's the analytic bootstrap, that this could be quite powerful in for the 4D theory. So these are these beautiful techniques that allow you to study, exploit the analyticity and spin of the conformal data and treat the bootstrap analytically and then in control at the same time all the operators on a single regio trajectory. And these methods also should work very well at large n. So one intriguing hint that this method should, this analytic bootstrap should go well together with the data of integrability is that there is this famous inversion formula that reconstructs the conformal data out of the double discontinuity of the correlator. And at large n, the double discontinuity is known to be determined only by single trace operators, which are the data we have full control on from integrability. And it's also very intriguing that there are some very beautiful results using the analytic bootstrap perturbatively in 1/n. And in particular, this was used to solve for the 4-point function of local operators in n equals 4 in the supergravity limit at strong coupling. So this limit was used because in that case, the single trace spectrum decoupled. And the bootstrap alone gave these results, for example, for the double trace data. But a natural question that would be nice to explore is if using the data from integrability, one can extend these results to finite lambda. That's the end. Thank you very much for your attention.
Very good. Let's thank Andrea. So I think some people had to run because there was a fire alarm at PI like 1 minute ago. So, or 4 minutes, 3 minutes ago. So, but hopefully some people ignored the fire alarm, as one should. So, any questions for Andrea?
I have a question. So can you go back to that that slide with the yes this one? So you're doing the numerical bootstrap, you want to shrink the bounds, right? So yes. Is it possible that you can use the analytic version of the numerical bootstrap? For example, there was a paper by Nima and collaborators where they proposed the geometric picture, the polytop picture that mimics the numerical bootstrap. So they find the geometric polytope, which is the conformal blocks, the set of conformal, the vector spaces formed by a set of conformal blocks. It's very similar to the numerical picture. And then they use the crossing symmetry as a hyperplane intersecting that polytope. And on the boundary, they obtain some solutions, which can be obtained analytically. So is it possible that you can do that with your theory to obtain some analytic bounds on this spectrum and then use that analytic bounds to see the bounds on these OP coefficients? I mean, it will be a little bit lengthier calculation since you're looking for high precision, but I'm just asking, is it feasible to think of an analytic version of the numerical bootstrap in terms of the geometric picture?
Mm-hmm. We haven't tried and or thought about
because that. Why I was saying it because your conformal blocks are actually functions of one variable, right? Because you're in 1D.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So since it's not a function of two variables in one variable, I think the geometric polytope picture will be quite feasible to enforce. And then you can actually look at those. So for example, you take one operator and then you impose the crossing symmetry, you get some delta minus to delta plus. The delta minus is the lower bound and delta plus is the upper bound, and then you can compute them as functions of coupling, maybe asymptotically. And then at least you can
see. It will be the same as what they did, but worse.
I'm sorry, worse, do you think?
Yeah, it will be doing what they did, but by hand. I mean, of course, you will do less less functional and so on. If you do a simple functional, you can do analytically, right? And see geometrically what's going on, but.
If you're using.
I know.
Yes, I know. I mean, that's what I was asking.
What you're proposing is a particular type of functionals, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Which has
right.
some geometric meaning, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because we scanned kind of the complete set of all functionals. I mean, within like some cutoff and found like the best out of them. So I doubt like the one which has the most beautiful geometric picture is the best for the purpose of this particular problem.
I see.
Okay. Could be like a weak coupling for some reason that there is some enhanced symmetry or something like that. But at weak coupling, you can actually use this first method with random sampling and it gives seven digits, like with like just five levels.
That was the question. Okay, thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, what is known about 3-point functions from integrability, about this the 3-point function that you extract?
It's one loop, I think, should have computed from hexagon.
That's it? Nothing more is known about them? I thought you had some quantum spectral curve for some of these 3-point
functions.
I know,
but only in maybe
the ladders
for the fishnet.
Yeah.
For the ladder.
So not here. So, for example, you had the box, Andrea, in one of the slides, you had the box saying for a topological quantity, here is some Bessel function, right? That Bessel function can be derived from quantum spectral curve?
Yes, yes. That's related to the Bremsstrahlung.
That's exactly
remember with Amit, we were computing this insertion of Z to the L?
Yes.
If you take L to be 1, that's exactly the right-hand side of this equation, but no one cites us.
But yeah, on the quantum spectral curve, you can derive this the near BPS expansion of this cusp, which is related to the.
But otherwise, the ones that you are extracting, you don't know how to compute from integrability.
No, I mean, of course, yeah. The hope is maybe through SOV. There is some magic formula, but we are
still to be discovered.
Are a bit far in the ladders or fishnet limits. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have a last question. It's a stupid question. So can you go to the last slide where you showed some prospects regarding the Polyakov bootstrap? I just want to understand what. So is it the Polyakov approach to the bootstrap, like making the crossing symmetric combination, and then, so what is this?
There is a Polyakov approach to the bootstrap, and so I don't know if that is in a concrete form in general, but in 1D, it was made into a very explicit set of equations.
So and do you expect something more from this approach and then you already have, or
But they look like very, very very different set of equations that mathematically it's supposed to be equivalent to the one we're using.
Yeah.
Because they look so different, maybe.
But it's a constraint equation on the same theory. So I was just wondering whether you will get additional information or do you expect some kind of a. Sorry?
I think so. So, yeah, you know, there are some rules in this 1D and so on, but basically, just some analytically computed functionals which are very far from optimal in our case. So, they're actually optimal functional in for the free spectrum. But again, for free spectrum, you can just do this random sampling and be happy. But otherwise, they're very far from optional. But it's just a different set of functionals, to my opinion. I don't know. Andre is a big fan of them somehow.
No, I don't know.
Yeah, but I was wondering that the essence of the thing is basically the same, right? I mean, you do the bootstrap this way or that way. Yes. At the end of the day, you're just doing bootstrap.
Yeah, that's just, exactly. Yeah, manifestation of crossing formula.
Right.
No matter how you do.
Exactly. No matter how you do, you will end up getting the same thing. I was just wondering whether, is it computation is simple, or do you expect, like, if you go to higher orders or something, then you expect one approach to be more feasible than the other. Yeah, but I understand. Yes.
Well, the only advantage is those functions are analytic. All the rest are mostly numerical.
Right.
And you have many of them. Like, the advantage is here we kind of have one function.
Right. Yes.
And there they have an explicit form for it, as many as you want.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you. Sorry, I asked a lot of questions, sorry.
Is there an even simpler problem you could consider? For example, is there some similar defect in the fishnet?
Yes, one can try to mimic Wilson lines by integrating scalars, and yes. And yeah, We want to try to study something in the fishnet a little bit, but we haven't done it yet.
Basically, in fishnet is easier to generate lots of spectrum, but sorry, it's my daughter speaking. It's easier to generate lots of spectrum, but then you lose unitarity. So depending on whether you care about this specific notion, you may be worried or not. But otherwise, of course, you can probably get something to play with there, which seems simpler. And there we have actually some predictions from like integrability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. Cool. I hope everyone is safe. And the fire alarm was just a random fire alarm, and those that survived, let's please thank Andrea one last time. And thanks a lot, Andrea, and hope to see you in person soon.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the question.